Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
Technique can take you so far, but then it's, how do I develop the eye to see something that others can't and make them see it?
Hello and welcome to the Learn to Paint podcast, the show where we work to answer the question, how do you get better at painting? I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers. And in this week's interview, I'm talking with artist Dean Mitchell. Mitchell works across several media, but we're focusing today's conversation on his watercolor work. In the conversation, you'll learn the value of surrounding yourself with good artwork, the importance of practicing confidence, and why learning good design starts when you ask the question, why do I love this painting? Plus, a whole lot more. Patreon supporters at Glossin' Up, be on the lookout for the bonus conversation with Mitchell next week. We get into how Mitchell makes light areas interesting and why it's important to know your purpose for a painting. Also, I just made a Patreon change. All Patreon supporters will now get early access to episodes. So if you want our next guest conversation a week early, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/support to find the Patreon link. And as always, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode30 to find show notes and to add your name to the newsletter list. All right, here we go.
Hi, Dean. Welcome to the podcast. How did you get started in art?
Hello, Kelly. The way I got started was my grandmother bought me a paint-by-number set, and that's really what got me interested in art and drawing and painting, was my grandmother buying a set like that.
And then you went to art school. Did you focus on watercolor in art school, or how did you find watercolor?
Actually, I found watercolor by seeing a friend of mine's portfolio, and that's what really got me interested in watercolor. I was mainly oil paintings and more of a dense medium. And no, pen and ink, actually, pen and ink, too.
If you weren't studying it at the university, did you then create your own self-study, or how did you approach teaching yourself then how to paint watercolor?
I was so fascinated with this student's work that I went to the library and I checked out every book I could possibly check out on watercolor, on different techniques, on different approaches. I also looked at a lot of different artists who worked in the medium itself. Yeah, I just experimented a lot. I was pretty daring. I wasn't trying to create anything right away. I just wanted to learn what I could actually do with the medium and how to handle it.
For you, when you were first getting started, what was the trickiest part of it?
The trickiest part was actually, I imagine, mixing the paint, knowing the surface that you're working on, because that can also change how the paint moves about on a surface. So experimenting a lot with just not necessarily a subject, but just pushing and moving the paint around to see what I could do with it.
Especially because if you're studying oil officially, and you put down a brush stroke and there it stays. And watercolor, that's not so true.
Watercolor is almost, I don't want to say it's a drawing medium, but in some ways it is, because I learn a lot by doing gesture drawings, especially with watercolor. Once I got to understand the medium a little bit more and understand how direct it was, and in a way, very unforgivable once you put a mark down. Now, there are some surfaces that you can lift the paint up slightly if it's a hot press surface. And there, like I said, there's different surfaces that I learned over the years by experimenting with it, and different effects that you can get with different types of surfaces.
We can look at artwork and just feel an emotional response to it, or we can look at it with a learner's eye. When you were looking at these artists that you really admired, how were you analyzing what they were doing with the idea of then that would teach you where to head next?
It's certainly different looking in a book. Looking in a book is great, and you can get a lot of information through words. But there's nothing like seeing an original where an artist may have possibly dragged the brush a certain way. Certain parts of it is more dense than other parts are more translucent. And so you get this nice, interesting push and pull kind of thing with depending on what the artist is doing. And you don't always get that in a book. We all know when we go to a museum, it's a totally different sensibility when you're before the original versus looking at a reproduction, because a reproduction cannot pick up all the subtleties. Now, of course, with digital now, we certainly have made extraordinary advances with that. But there's nothing more telling than seeing the original. And really, if you can sneak and get closer in to look, as we know, museums have to be very careful with that, looking very closely. And I was constantly dissecting something mentally, whether I knew exactly how the artist did it or not. I was looking at a possibility where I could get the same effects based on the fact that I experimented with it a lot. So experimentation, I cannot push that enough, because through experimentation, you become more daring, you become more less, it becomes more intuitive when you experiment a lot.
Were you experimenting with finished paintings, or were, like, was that the direction you were heading, or were you truly sitting with the paper, playing with the paint, trying to get an effect?
First of all, I did try initially trying to control the paint and trying to come up with a visual image. But I found that extremely frustrating because I didn't understand how much to wet the surface, what the paint would do if I wet it too much, would it bleed? And so I moved away from just trying to make an image into just playing with the paint. And I moved back and forth between a non-objective experimentation and creating a likeness of something. Because I could look and say, oh, I could probably use that effect to get this. And so I began to actually analyze what I could do trying to recreate reality through this experimentation. But so often, a lot of people, when they first start using watercolor, as I said, they're very extremely careful. And I was the same way. But I realized that if you really want the work to have some emotion and some meat to it, you have to really let it go. You have to just let it go and anticipate what it might possibly do. And sometimes you don't always know. And sometimes, because you've experimented so much, you go with the flow and make it work. It becomes, it's almost like the medium almost becomes a part of you. If it does that kind of reaction, you can't totally control it, but you can push it here and make it give you what you want.
You mentioned about being timid with watercolor. Do you think that you can practice confidence?
Oh, absolutely. I remember teaching a class where people were so timid, and I was like, why are you so timid? And it was afraid to. I said, but you have plenty of materials. I have no problem starting over if something doesn't work. And there's been times where I put a lot in something and I just made the wrong move and it was just totally gone. I would just start over. Is it frustrating? Absolutely. But starting over from those mistakes, it gives you the confidence. It just does. And the more you examine a subject, the more you become familiar with it. Like, I do a lot of drawing and sketches of something to the point where, like, there are certain subjects that I've done, I can almost paint them without anything. I could look at my drawing and then I know, because I've studied the structure in so many different angles and so many ways, I know exactly what I'm going to do before I even put the first stroke down. There is a freedom in knowledge. There's a certain kind of intuitive, intellectual freedom with knowledge when you're working in paint. It just is.
That freedom and knowledge is so hard to understand when you're beginning, because all you're doing is running into lack of knowledge, and it's deeply frustrating.
Yes.
And it's deeply discouraging. Do you think that someone really wants to get to the point where they can throw down paint and do work wet into wet and that kind of expressiveness in watercolor, do they have to start there, or can they start with more basics that are more controlled, or should they be working on that more uncontrolled part of that?
For example, I will go back to drawing again. I remember my first drawing class when we did gesture drawings where we had 30 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. I learned so much from that, but there was some structure to it. And I think that with watercolor, it's nature, it's fluid, but you can do different things with it. Dry brush techniques, there's wet and wet. There's all kinds of approaches. But for me as a painter, I have always, initially, I used to put down quite a bit of drawing. And the more drawing I had down, the more confined I felt. And so it felt like filling in a coloring book kind of thing. I didn't want that. I wanted that freedom I had in drawing class where I did caught something in 5 seconds, 30 seconds. I wanted that kind of spontaneity. So the only way I could get there was to do very little drawing, suggest these elements where I wanted to place them, and then I let the language of paint created as the thing emerged. So it's very difficult to sometimes explain the abstract quality of paint. You can say a lot if you understand how to minimize detail and use the paint to your advantage with a few lines to suggest everything you want to say without having to render every piece of the. People have told me, wow, that's really, it looks like it's rendered, but it's not. What I've done is I've abstracted, but I put in key elements that your eye just automatically fills it in. And that's the nice movement that you can make people think that there's something there that's not there. It's all an illusion. But that's all through experimentation and learning about the medium, because different colors and different temperatures can do different things in a space. It can pull you forward. It can push you back very quickly, depending on how broad the stroke is or how thin the stroke is, or what the contrasting of the stroke is, the density of the stroke, the swiftness of the stroke. All that can define a space for you, different than it can in drawing.
What is the importance of drawing?
Drawing is, it's just the foundation. You cannot escape drawing. It just is. I had a drawing class in college, life drawing class, and I can still see the instructor in my head right now when he walked through the class to see how we were drawing, and we were drawing the head and then adding the arms and the legs and all this stuff. And he sits down and he does these gesture drawings, drawing after drawing, move 30 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And then when he finally slowed it down to 15 seconds or 20 seconds or 30, even a minute, you had the whole figure there. It was mesmerizing. And drawing teaches you to see quickly. I like quick sketches. It teaches you to see and get information fast and quickly. And if you look at some of the greatest artists, when you get up on the work, sometimes it's almost darn near just, it's almost, I don't want to say it's sloppy, but sometimes it's just, it's very spontaneous. And there's not a lot there. There's not a lot of blending. There's not a lot. It's just, it's very gestural. And you can build on that. Good drawing. I cannot tell you enough about how important drawing gives you a lot of confidence. Because if you have good drawing, eventually you can learn technique and you can learn different formulas for mixing paint. There's plenty of information out there on videos with all kinds of stuff. People are telling you use color charts and all kinds of stuff. There's all kind of stuff about that. But drawing, that's you. That is all you. That is straight from you and from your soul. You need that drawing.
When listening to you speak, I'm struck by sort of what you were saying with your own art, is that the brain can fill so much in. It's incredible how much the brain can fill in. But there's some stuff the brain needs. And I'm really struck by like how one angle can perfectly capture a cheek. But if that is just 1 degree off, it doesn't. And it's incredible how drawing, if you can capture that angle of a cheek, you can just say so much without explicitly saying anything because you have that one thing that is true.
There's something about the way the eye sees abstractly. I do think there is something to that. There is something about being able to capture a form, and the eye is constantly interrelating other forms. And so that one information can almost make you fill in other parts, depending on if you have enough slight information about the nose or whatever it is, you can almost tell exactly who it is because you've captured that part with such perfection and such directness that it's inescapable. That's a wonderful way of abstracting a form and creating that illusion of likeness if that's what you're after. But yeah, it's the human mind is an amazing thing, and how it retains information is pretty miraculous. That's why I said even with certain colors, creating visual language and mixing, your eye is actually filling that in because you have two different colors there. So your eye is actually, it's what you call visual mixture, but your brain is actually doing that for you. And so creating, feeding that information back to you. But I tell you, you want to learn how to do anything in painting and all that. Like I said, you can learn techniques and learn formulas. But drawing, that's going to be your telling thing. It's also very telling when you paint. The people are very careful and got to fill it all in, unless that's just after photorealism, which is a whole another conversation. But if you really want something spontaneous and direct, you need good drawing for that.
Let's back up just a little bit and talk about materials just briefly to give people a sense. Watercolor, obviously, but what kind of paints are on your palette? And I don't necessarily mean brand, but what are the characteristics of the paint on your palette and why those?
There are certain paints that have a more translucent quality to them. And then there are other paints that have a little bit more dense quality. There's usually a mixture for me, because what makes a watercolor work is really the paper, is learning how to use the paper to your advantage. Some of the greatest watercolors truly are, the paper really plays a major role in that. And learning your materials and learning what paints are more translucent and what paints are more dense can give you a sense of what you want to do with any, you know, object. No different than if you're doing work in oils, it's the same thing, except watercolor is, you can't scrape it off, it's down. So I can't push people enough to experiment and understand what, and by experimenting, you can tell which paints will mix well together. Once they run together, will they create a nice airy feeling of color, or will they create mud? So learning what paints mix together when they're wet plays a role in the painting have a freshness to it. I love this medium because it's just rich with so many ways you can work with it. But without that knowledge, you're going to run into a lot of frustration.
Because I feel like when people are first getting started, they think about two colors running together, and it's a color issue, not that it's not just about color. It's about literally how those paints physically work together.
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain colors that I know depending on if you're working in a more high key with watercolor or you're working in a more low palette, there are certain colors that work well in a low key. And then there are others that work better in a higher key, depending on how you're wetting the surface and creating an overall family of color with whatever you're doing. And again, I think that when you experiment and you become, it's kind of like a dance. There's a certain amount of freedom in art that you can't always get by. Structure will give you information that you will later pull on intuitively. Because sometimes structure can inhibit creativity. And so I love this line about what Picasso said, I have to now learn to unlearn and become more like a child so I can be more creative. There is something to that in the use of watercolor. Yes, you can put down your lines and you can fill them in and you can do all that. But then at a certain point when you want that freedom, put down less lines and less lines. I've done complete paintings with no drawing. And I love doing paints with no drawing. It's hard, but boy, do I love it. They don't always come out, but it sure is fun.
You mentioned the importance of paper. So what paper or board do you work on? And then what does that allow you to do?
I work on a acid-free Crescent watercolor board. It's a hot press. I work on Fabriano paper. I'll work on anything that's archival. And I like working on different surfaces because there are some surfaces that really suck the paint in, really sucks it up. Then the other surfaces where the paint rides slightly, which is a little harder to work with because sometimes if you're not careful, you can lift another layer up and you wind up with mud. But I've experimented with so many different surfaces, and I like that. Again, by experimenting, then you can figure out your own temperament and what surfaces fits your personality, your subject matter, your approaches to it. There are certain things that are like hot press paper you can easily lift, but you have to be careful if you're doing superimposed washes where there's a wash over top of a wash. Because there are some of my paintings that I will start off extremely light and build it up like a sculptor. I will layer the paint through abstract shapes, but they begin to form the real. Through small strokes, broad strokes, I can create a face through just structural laying of washes. But I had to know what the principle of the colors that I'm using, what's more transparent, what's more dense. Do I want this color, once I put it down, to create an optical illusion of a third color? So you create the illusion of flesh through layering of transparent superimposed washes. And then sometimes when I'm doing a person of color, I will start with a really dark and then move the nuances around the dark. I know some people want, you know, they'll ask me about certain paintings of mine and they'll see all these blues and greens. When they get up on it, there's all these subtle colors in there, but there's also this deep, rich dark. And they'll say, sometimes my dark is so dead, it doesn't look like alive like yours does. And I sort of use it. And they would tell me like brown or sepia. And I said, there lies your problem. I said, it's okay to use those colors, but you need to put color inside of those colors. And I said, I'll wet a surface and I'll drop a rose madder or a indigo blue or different blues within that. I'll wet it, but it has a rich feeling where there's reds in there and there's blues in there and you have this rich, lush feeling. And so it's not like this black hole where you look at something that looks dark and dull. You got to put color in there because there's nuances even within the darkest of darks. There are nuances and shadows.
Well, and also what I hear you saying, though, is that know how you're going to approach that subject, because if you want to do a bunch of layers, if you're going to do shape over shape, you better choose a paper that's not just going to fight you on that and have every shape lift up the shape underneath.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because some surfaces are, the paint doesn't absorb totally into the paper like some do. Some really hold it. There's some that have more tooth to it and really hold it. And then the others, like I said, it rises surface. And those are the kinds of surfaces where you want to be very quick and spontaneous, know exactly what you want to do. Because if you don't and you start trying to push your paint around and doing it, you're going to get mud. So that's why I like different surfaces, because even if I'm working on different papers, I can apply certain elements to other surfaces regardless. I can do superimposed washes on a paper that holds paint really well, but I can't do it on the slicker surfaces. It has to be more direct. But it teaches me a certain spontaneity and a certain directness that I can marry it with either. It doesn't matter what surface it is. I can marry it because I understand the paint.
The surface you're working on, does it also affect edge quality?
Yes. Again, you have to know how much to wet a surface if you want that edge to be soft. Now, sometimes I've done paintings where the paint doesn't quite move and give me the edge I want, and it'll start trying to create a line. And what I do is I hit it with a spray or animazor type thing, and then I grab something and I blot it so that I get the edge that I want. And then I may tilt the paper slightly so that it really looks like it's fading off into the distance. As opposed to hoping that it might do what I want, I force it on some level to give me what I want.
Listening to you describe that experience, I know our listeners who paint in watercolor will all be thinking like, no, like that feeling when you're in your studio, like it's, oh no.
It's not what I want. I've taken things where sometimes when I'm painting very direct, I go, oh, that's way too dark. And I grab a wet paper towel and I blot it real hard and I push it away and then I go right back in it because I've sucked up enough of the water out of the paper. Now I know I can drag the brush and create the effect I want because I pulled enough of the water out just by blotting it. And it's slightly damp where I could do something else that I see as possible.
Then for your paints, do you lay out fresh paints every time, or are you working with paints that have already set or paints that have already dried?
Depends on what it is. If it's a portrait, I'm usually going to start with fresh color. If it's a structure, I work on a meat tray, so there's colors everywhere. Stuff is running together and all kinds of stuff. But I know from working with the paint, I can wipe a certain part of it off and get it really clean and grab some of the paint that's still there on the tray and use it to my advantage. If it's a small painting, I usually do that as well. But a portrait or something like that, where I'm feeling that I really need fresh, clean color, I'm going to wipe it all off. And sometimes I wipe it off anyway, because dust, unless you place something over it, dust will get in. You get all these little irregularities in the washes, which is going to create a whole nother. There's nothing like dust in your paint overnight that you just happen to just leave out. And so you don't want that either.
I guess then, how many colors do you generally work with at this point in your career?
There's a lot of different colors I work with. A lot of blues. Here's the thing about the workshop, now that you asked me about color. People will ask me, what color is that? What color is that? And sometimes I don't have the exact blue I want, and I'll grab another blue that I don't normally use. And I'll say, what blue is that? I said, I'm really not sure, but I think I can probably mix it and make it work here for me. So there's a lot of blues and there's earth tones. There's also certain paints that I know will make nice grays, like blues and umbers will get you a nice gray. No different than oil painting. Because when I'm really wanting to do something, I really research things. I'm really a researcher where I'll read everything I can read about it. And I'm the same way with acrylics or oils or anything. When I'm ready to truly dive in and try to perfect something, I just research it like nobody's business. And I will experiment and I'll try anything. I'll try different surfaces. It's an open playbook. Nobody's watching me. So I don't care if I mess up. Now, if I'm in a workshop, sometimes you're a little bit more conscientious because you have people watching you. And then there's sometimes I make mistakes on purpose. And then the last time I gave a demonstration was at the Laguna Beach College of Art and Design. I had a drawing and I did a nice complete painting without putting any drawing down. And it was like, did you put any drawing down? No. And so I was really fascinated with the students because they said, it's like calligraphy. I said, yeah, that's exactly what it is. So I said, I didn't put any drawing down on purpose because I wanted you to see that you could do everything with a brush without putting any lines down. There's nothing wrong with the lines, but I want you to see that you can actually create something. But then they asked me about doing a portrait and I didn't have any drawings. So what I did was I took out one color and I chiseled out a little head. Just you could see the eyes, the socket, the nose with just a few strokes. I said, it's the same principle as me doing an architectural structure. I said, if you don't get so caught up into the likeness and just look at shapes and forms, you'll be surprised how quickly you can form the real through simplicity. It's no different when you're plein air painting. People say, what's the best thing to learn how to plein air paint is to simplify. Abstract. That's the best way to learn how to paint from life. You really learn to paint from life. Some people paint a lot from photographs, but if you really want to learn how to edit, working from life teaches you that right away. So even when you have your photographic reference, you will know what to do exactly to get enough information to give the viewer exactly what they need.
A lot of people, especially when we're starting, we think of the process as the painting only, like paint to paper, but there's got to be a lot of thinking that happens before you begin a painting. And so first off, how do you even decide what to paint?
If you come to my studio, I'm probably working on probably between 40, 50 things. I don't have the ability to just work on one thing. I tend to jump around a lot. I work in sometimes three mediums during the course of a day. But for the most part, it all plays off one another. I can start off in watercolor in the morning. Next thing I know, I'm looking at acrylic. Now I'm working in oil. Then I'm back to the watercolor. And so by, believe it or not, working in the more heavy, dense mediums, when I go back to the watercolor, I'm even freer because I've done something more physical with paint. And so now I'm moving lighter. It's like lifting weights or something. It's like when you do something very physical and suddenly you're back over to something light, it frees me with watercolor. It's amazing how that plays off for me when I'm working in watercolor. I become even more daring after I've worked in a denser medium. I don't know why that is. And I wind up at an easel and I never stay at easel. I'm usually on the floor, over top of it, dropping the paint. Sometimes it's upright. And then I can't get the effect I want. I pull it off of the easel. I drop it on the floor. I'm throwing water on it. I'm putting paint on, I'm dropping, I'm letting it drip off from my brush because the brush is so loaded with paint, I'm letting it drip. And that's why people see that spontaneity in some of my work. I'm letting the paint literally drip out of the brush all over the surface. And those accidents I then turn and move into something else by drawing a line swiftly through it. You get this lost and found line where one part of the paper is wetter than the other part. So you get a more of a fuzz situation. And as you push it out, where you get more of a thin, thick line. And you create this wonderful kind of musical dance with paint, but you're creating an image at the same time, but you're giving people so many different sensations by the drips and the drops. And there are certain parts that are very refined. There are certain parts that of a wash that's very bold and open. And so you're constantly, it's like music. You hear all these different notes playing. It's just fun. That's how I approach my work. Now, certainly there's sometimes a subject matter involved, but how I approach it is totally intuitive. I'm not always sure exactly how it's going to come out, but for the most part, because I've used certain elements a lot, I can almost anticipate it's going to work. And sometimes when I've started something and I've done something, I know right away in a few strokes, it's not going to work. I got to start over. This isn't going to work. I got to start over. And I grab another piece of paper and I start over again. But I can use that information sometimes and incorporate it in the other work. So that mistaken work becomes like a study on top of the other process that I'm now restarting. You know what I mean? It becomes a part of the intellectual process of painting. So it's not thrown away where it's a lost cause. I'm now referring to it. It's right next to me as I'm painting another painting, referring to it in some way that I can use that information. Even if it's a lost situation, I can still use it in some way.
That subtle thing you just explained is one of the big mindset differences between someone who is an established painter and someone who's just getting started. Like, you see that as a stepping stone to the next thing as opposed to a piece of proof that you should quit.
Yeah, it's information to me. It's information to me because sometimes even in painting, there are certain areas of painting that work really well and other areas that didn't work really well. I can almost remember exactly what happened, even though it's an intuitive process. I said, okay, that I left it a little too wet there. I probably should have done this. And so I can then anticipate and still maintain that spontaneity. But because of that information I just did, it's fresh in my head. And sometimes I move even quicker because it's just, I'm doing it. I'm constantly doing it. So it's, again, it's information that I feel I can use. So I refer to it while I'm working.
So then how do you know a scene will be a good subject for painting? Or is it more about whether or not you can make it a good subject for painting?
Ah, that's a good question. Actually, there are certain things that I can spot right away. I see things abstractly. I had a junior high school teacher that told me that I see shapes first before I see anything else. I see small squares and triangles. And I didn't realize this until he explained it to me. I did a painting. He was saying, oh, it's really abstract. And I said, what do you mean, Mr. Harris? He said, you see really abstractly. But my technique wasn't very good. But he said, boy, your eye for abstraction is extraordinary. When I see something, I can spot something right away in terms of the way the light's hitting it, what kind of form, whether it's a triangle or rectangle or square. Or that's how I see things. And the rest of it is just information after that. But there are certain things that I look at. Even when I was teaching drawing, I'm constantly looking at the object, around the object, through the object. It's not always what's in front of me. It's what's around the object that creates that thing. And so I'm conscientious of something that's around something and not just looking at what it is. And so I can spot things very quickly in terms of what I think they will make a good composition. Now, sometimes do I look at something like, I like it, but I don't like how that light hits that and that shape hits that. So I'll make it a little bigger, a little bolder, depending on what I want to make dominant in it. And again, you can make something dominant through color or through size relationship or through depending on how you approach it, whether it's an edge done very sharply or done very soft. That can push you forward or push you back. And the color, the same thing. But when I'm looking at objects and I'm constantly shifting colors on things. It's not always what I see. It's I put my own color to it, my own language to it.
What do you have figured out before you begin a painting? And then how do you figure that out? Is that through sketchbooks? Is that through thumbnails? Is it through writing? Is it just through thinking?
It's actually through all of the above. A lot of it is drawing, and it's usually just almost like black and white, just really dark shapes, like dark masses. And with watercolor, I'm looking at it like the white of the paper. And so all the subtle in-between things, what I need is a good variety of strong shapes, a variety of shapes. That's what makes a good composition, is good variety of shapes. And you can create a certain harmony if you're recognizing the repetition in the imagery that you're doing. So you create a harmony in your painting through triangles or rectangles, or depending on, you can see what's a dominant shape in a composition. If you really look at artwork, you can see there's certain kinds of movement. And because of that repetition, you create a certain kind of harmony. And by doing a lot of sketches like that, you can train your eye to see shapes and the way light hits things very quickly. And you learn how to abstract. You can learn how to abstract things that way, where you're breaking it down to the bare basics.
So then you have figured out like your value pattern.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then I know a lot of this is probably unconscious at this point because you are so experienced, but how much have you decided about like edges? How consciously have you thought about these are going to be the hard edges and then everything else is soft? Or what does that thinking look like before you begin the painting?
Looking at something in terms of what I want to be dominant. And again, you can create a sense of dominance through size relationship or color, depending on, for example, I've done a lot of barn scenes. Sometimes if I'm at an open field or something, I'm doing sketches, the barn may be in a distance and I go, that's really interesting. But then I'll go, I need something to pull my eye closer. And suddenly what I'll do is I'll draw a strong line not over the barn, but close in next to it, and I'll create a block, a big square, and that square area will become another side of a barn that's not even there. I'll put boards there or clapboards there, but it's really a big shape. And so what I've done is the barn that I'm looking at and then the other shape creates this nice tension of illusion of a shape where it pushes your eye back, but it pulls your eye forward through this contrasting element that I just added because I felt that it would make the composition more interesting. So there are things like that you may not see in life, but you can exaggerate and make it more interesting. I'm constantly looking at that because I've learned that variety of sizes and relationships create a certain amount of interest in a space. And so learning how that movement happens, I learned by looking at Franz Kline, Robert Motherwell, Richard Diebenkorn, particularly even Matisse did some very interesting still lifes with just almost like a very minimalist palette. The way you could see all these different angles in the way he looked, sometimes a bird eye perspective and all these different angles and variations of nuances of gray browns and stuff. But it created this nice illusion of space and all kinds of things. So I'm always looking at a lot of art and looking at what I consider great art, because you want to look at really finely mastered works, because you can also mess up your eye by looking at things that aren't so great. I hate to say it that way, but there are certain works of art that are just master works. And so you can train your eye by looking. And then by looking at things that are masterfully done, you can also begin to look at your own work and analyze it through the same lens and go, wow, that's if I do this. And so you're pulling that information that you've acquired and you're pulling it into your work. It's still your voice, but you're pulling it into your work, except that it may be a particular subject that you're doing. But it's just like looking at Degas' work. And I love the way he crops things, the way he abstracted things. There was this kind of beauty in his work that was not always accurate. And sometimes he would do an arm or something with pastel, and you'll see another arm there, and a subtle drawing coming through. And that creates this interesting, this thought process. And so when I'm doing paintings, I see that same kind of process with watercolor. You may have a line in there that doesn't quite work, but it creates some kind of interest because you've corrected it in some way, but it creates a different kind of language when you're looking at something. And then you feel the hand of the artist. You feel the mind of the artist working when you see all of these kind of mistakes there, but he's done something to and not necessarily correct it, but he's married it and made it beautiful. Not looked at as a total loss, but he's married it and made it beautiful. And I love an artist who can leave her mistakes or his mistakes in something and still pull it up to a place where it's even the mistakes are beautiful. I just love artwork like that. So when I'm doing watercolor, any kind of painting, I love that. You feel the artist thinking and trying to capture something emotionally, spiritually, and you feel it.
For someone who's just getting started, composition can feel like such a sort of overwhelming task. How does someone even start to think about something like shapes, to learn to think that way? Maybe especially if thinking abstractly is not their strong point.
That's interesting. I had a design class in college that I thought one of the assignments that was given was we were told to take a blank piece of white paper and cut up all these different size squares and move them around and create an interesting composition with just different size squares. And then another assignment was to take just lines, straight lines, and create something interesting. And that taught me a lot. And I didn't realize, I thought, oh my God, this is so crazy. We're like cutting these squares up, moving blocks around and different sizes. And we did a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, during the semester. I thought, oh, this is so crazy. And then when I did my first book that I self-published, I recognized from putting a picture on a white surface and where type goes at and all this stuff, there is an art form to that, how much negative space around it to give it to breathe. All these things can teach you how to, even when you're looking at a magazine ad, an advertisement, you can look at something and say, wow, that's really beautifully done. Why is that beautifully done? And I look at everything that way. I look at a home that way. When I've gone into homes, I said, it's big, but it's uninteresting. The design is not very good. Big house, but the layout's not very interesting. And so I begin to look at every furniture that way, quality of something, how something flows. And the same thing when I see an architect or building, I'm constantly looking at things from an aesthetic standpoint, a functional standpoint, and a certain kind of element of beauty and risk involved as well. You can teach yourself how to see something. Now, I did have a teacher who, he was the dean of the college. His name was Joseph Canzani. And he said one of the hardest things to teach was design and abstraction. He said that's one of the hardest things to teach someone. It makes sense because even in painting, to say more with less, very difficult. And to hold someone's attention with less. Now, you can hold somebody's attention. You've got a lot going on. You go, wow, there's a lot of people in there, a lot of this, a lot. But to take something simple and hold someone emotionally, spiritually, and just captivate them. And when you think about some of the most captivating paintings throughout history, they're very simple works. There's not a whole lot going on. You start thinking about it. When you start thinking about some of the great paintings, quite simple. Not all, but quite a bit. You can train your eye. It can be a challenge because, again, you have to understand aesthetically what is pleasing to the eye and why is that pleasing to the eye. When you look at a work of art and you really love it, ask yourself every time you look at it, why do I really like that? What is it, the way the artist has placed the elements? Is it the color harmony? Is it the contrast? Is it the, ask yourself all these different questions and you really can begin to teach yourself about design and how to look at something. Because when you're entering any kind of show or any kind of competition or anything else that you want to enter, particularly watercolor, you got a lot of competitions out here. You have to learn how to look at your work and be able to select what you feel is your best work. And those aesthetics will play a role in that because you're sending them before jurors who are very in tune to composition and whether you can capture them with what you've done. So that's a huge part of it.
I know you work a couple of different ways depending on the subject matter, but could you give us a bird's eye view of your process?
There is usually a drawing involved. Something I always have something to refer to in some ways. And some drawings are more detailed than others depending on what the subject is. And because I have certain elements around me, when I'm actually beginning the process of it, I have enough information around me that I can be a little bit freer. So I'm actually more direct if I have enough information around me. If I have less information, then I feel like I got to put more drawing down, I have to put more things down. But if I have other studies and other supporting elements around me, like for example, if I'm working on the floor, I may have 2, 3, 4 sketches on each side of me. I'm looking at the drawing and I'm looking at the paper and I'm pulling from those studies. So that's really pretty much my process. Now, there are times when there is nothing and I will make up things. I've made up faces and heads and different compositions. And that's just because I just enjoy that process because when I'm starting with nothing and I'm not looking at anything at all, it's all coming out of my imagination. That plays a role too when I get ready to paint. I'll go, wow, I don't like that over there. But if I put this shape over there, I can make that work. And I go, and I put that shape in there. But that's because I work from my imagination. So I can then pull from my imagination to make that thing work. And by not always having those supportive elements, because I've done things out of my head on my own, I can make something work, even if that element is not in my studies or drawings. I hope that makes sense to people. Because when I'm doing a head, sometimes it may have a sketch, but I got to make up the lighting. I've had people one time tell me, you got 2 light sources in there. Maybe. As an artist, you can do whatever you want. So I never limit myself in terms of how I approach anything. It is totally an open field. Yes, there are certain colors that I do, but sometimes I grab another color depending on, I go, I need something really deep over there and I'll grab a deeper color that I know is more dense because I need to really push that. I don't have enough strength in the other colors that I've used. And by being more daring that way, you'll surprise yourself in what you'll wind up creating sometimes. It's a lot of fun. And sometimes it's scary because you got a lot of work in something. But at the same time, boy, when it works and it's moving, it's great.
If someone came to you and said, I want to be really good at painting, what advice would you give them?
You have to decide what is good at painting mean to you. That's number one. But as we know, there are basic things like learning design and composition and color. And there are certain things that you can learn. And then there's another level that requires more from you. And sometimes what has to be tossed aside is any form of what I would call commercialism, because we live in a very driven culture that is driven by money. And so we all have to make money. I certainly understand all that. But there is a part where that has to be let go to pursue something on a different level. And there might not always be an audience for that work. That audience may be 5 years down the road. They may stack up in your studio for a number of years, because I've had that happen to me. But the work will have a power to it. And when a work has power to it, it can be haunting and disturbing. And in some ways, unwanted. That's real power in a work. We've seen this over and over throughout history where artists have taken risks and the work sat in their studios and nobody wanted it. And they took a certain kind of person to believe in it and all kinds of stuff. Even if much about the Barnes collection, the work that he was buying at the time wasn't really necessarily readily accepted by the artist of his day. It was sort of gotten known at some point. But what I'm saying is, as a painter, to get better, it is a matter of really looking at life and the human condition. That's going to make you a better painter. Technique can take you so far, but then it's, how do I develop the eye to see something that others can't and make them see it and see truth in it? How do you do that? That makes you a better painter. Technique, that's going to take you so far. But then what's really difficult is finding the underbelly of humanity that most do not want to grapple with. And that's what I think what makes Lucian Freud's work so powerful, is that he was willing to take the imperfections of the human flesh and put it on canvas in its rawest form. And it's magnificent and beautiful. Art is a really interesting thing. Once you learn technique and you get past certain basic elements, then you have to really challenge yourself. And that's very difficult. It's not easy. Not even for me. It's hard. It's really hard. What you don't want to do is just create a body of work. And you want to create something that has some merit to it, some beyond just a skill set.
You can learn more about Dean Mitchell at his website, deanmitchellstudio.com, and on Facebook and Instagram, and we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dean.
Kelly, it's just been a thrill, and you have been very delightful. Your questions were just wonderful. I appreciate you inviting me to be a part of the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me this week on the podcast. Head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode30 for show notes. While you're there, add your name to the newsletter list to get more ideas on how to get better at painting. And if you like the show and find yourself coming back episode after episode, consider supporting it. Head to learntopaintpodcast.com/support to learn more. And speaking of support, thank you to everyone who's supporting monthly through Patreon, and to High Gloss supporters Andrew Atterbury, Debbie Miller, and Rihanna DeRold. Happy painting!